thank you for tuning into the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC 105.3 FM Troy. I'm Jonah Moberg.
And I'm Tatiana Morani. We've got a lot of great stuff planned for you today.
This Saturday, community members rallied through Troy streets chanting for justice and accountability from the Troy Police Department for Dominic McDonald and Edwin Thevenin. Dominic and Edwin, at different unrelated times, were both shot by Troy police while in their vehicles. Dominic survived. Edwin, unfortunately, did not. My co-host and I attended the rally, and at the beginning of our show, we'll hear from some others that also attended the rally about their perspectives on what happened.
Last week, I met up with Uzma Popal, the volunteer coordinator of the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project, an organization that serves hundreds of meals to people all over the capital region every month. Uzma told me all about the great work they do, and we're going to share that interview on today's show.
Also, we'll hear from WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati, who interviewed the executive director and education coordinator of Tech Valley Game Space.
Also, Stanley Hatzel from Market Black Books is coming by the studio once again. With Turkey Day just the days away, Stanley's bringing us some food and Thanksgiving-themed books to get us in this holiday spirit. But before we get into all of that, we'll start the show off with some rapid-fire local headlines.
The Times Union reports that numerous ethics boards tasked with monitoring the conduct of elected officials and public employees have not met in years. Do not document their meetings and provide little information on their websites about how to file an ethics complaint. Critics of the patchwork system say the state legislature has failed to provide guidance on how local municipal ethics boards should operate. There is a need for such oversight, they said, because conflicts of interest are often an issue in small communities where nepotism can run rampant in government hiring.
The Newsday editorial board called the Long Island criminal justice system to stop mistreating Black and Latino people. The study by the paper of more than 100,000 police stops showed that a higher percentage of minority drivers are pulled over than white people. Once pulled over, the cars of minority drivers are more often searched than those of white people. Since their cars are more often searched, illegal drugs or weapons are more often found. These drivers are also far more likely than their white counterparts to be charged with crimes strongly linked to officer discretion, like resisting arrest or obstruction. Minorities are far more likely than whites to be charged with felonies when found with drugs. Whites are more likely than minorities to be charged with misdemeanors or not at all. Once convicted of a felony, minorities on Long Island are far more likely to be incarcerated than white people convicted of the same felonies. The percentage of non-whites found with marijuana who received some jail time was 5 times that of whites found with marijuana who received jail time.
Governor Cuomo's renaming of the Malcolm Wilson Tappan Zee Bridge in June, in the name of his father, Mario Cuomo, is continuing to generate controversy. Nearly 100,000 names have been collected on a petition in Westchester County, resident Michael Mann, to revert to just the Tappan Zee Bridge. Governor Cuomo, however, claimed that the petition is the work of a group backed by conservative megadonor Robert Mercer.
The Green Education and Legal Fund is recommending that the city of Troy adopt a volume-based garbage system, while also increasing incentives for recycling and starting a curbside composting program. The Green Group had first recommended a pay-as-you-throw system 17 years ago during the administration of Mayor Mark Pattison. The garbage issue has become a central focus of pending Troy City Council budget, since Mayor Patrick Madden has proposed a separate $190 per household annual fee for garbage. Critics have complained that a separate fee is a little more than a tax hike and that his proposal does little to reduce the amount of garbage that the city has to collect or landfill, thus not reducing cost.
The town supervisor in Waterford says that a test of water leaking from a pipe that drains from the Colony Town landfill into the Mohawk River found elevated levels of PFOA, a dangerous industrial chemical that has drawn increasing scrutiny after fouling the drinking water in Hoosick. The PFOA levels were slightly below the federal water safety standard. The town of Waterford has joined Half Moon to oppose a plan by Colony to double the size of his landfill along the banks of the Mohawk and hired a firm to test the water that drains from the landfill into the river. Waterford officials who paid for the test said that the test results indicate that at least more testing should be done. State environmental officials said that they regularly test the water in the area and will do additional tests next week.
The 2-week climate summit that just concluded in Bonn, Germany, saw delegates from nearly 200 countries work towards creating a rubric for implementing the Paris Climate Accord. Next year will be critical in reviewing process and how countries are reducing their carbon emissions, but host Germany admitted that it was falling short of its goals. And scientists said that pledges by individual countries fall far short of avoiding catastrophic climate change. 350.org said that the protest in the street were more important than the talks on the inside, with their renewed focus on the need for local governments to take bolder action to halt fossil fuels and transition to renewable energy. The Center for International Environmental Law said the United Nations unable to take effective action. It is time for the courts to step up and address climate change damages caused by fossil fuels.
Nebraska regulators approved the Keystone XL pipeline, removing the last big regulatory battle for the oil project after years of protests. The Nebraska Public Service Commission voted 3-2 to approve the route through the state for the pipeline that will transport up to 830,000 barrels per day of crude oil from Canada and North Dakota to oil refineries on the Gulf Coast. Former President Barack Obama had blocked the permits for the pipeline in 2015, citing the oil sands' impact on climate change. But Trump quickly reversed that decision after taking office. Politico reported that the approval came just days after the original Keystone pipeline ruptured and dumped 210,000 gallons of oil into a rural area of South Dakota. But Nebraska law barred regulators from considering spills or pipeline safety in its decision-making process. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to WOOC Hudson Mohawk Magazine on 105.3 FM.
And to learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, please visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
This past Saturday in Troy, there was a march to demand justice in the cases of Dominique McDonald, an unarmed man who was shot by the Troy police this past August, and Edson Thevenin, who was shot and killed by the Waterville police in 2016. Protesters called for the prosecution of the police officers involved in these shootings, and they demanded the resignation of Rensselaer County District Attorney Joel Abelov. Our WOOC correspondent Monica Mazur caught up with the protesters to hear their demands and their hopes for the future.
Hey, Don Monica. Thanks for coming.
No problem. How are you?
Good, good. So, like Jonah said, we both, you know, went to the rally and you went to the rally. What was something that you noticed about this rally that maybe shocked you?
I was honestly expecting more people to be there. I thought it was a very serious issue that there was enough public knowledge about. There was Facebook events, there were all the local news was covering it. And I just thought, like, honestly, when I even saw the approach the march, I thought there was going to be more people. And I thought, I mean, it was good that it was successful. There was a lot of great speakers. So that was also really awesome just to see, like, a few people take the lead and have such inspiring things to say to everyone that did come.
For sure. I noticed that, too. I definitely noticed that there wasn't as many people as I expected. And I'm not sure if it was maybe just they were afraid of the cold or what.
Yeah, I don't know. It's always, the crowds always seem smaller than they ought to, especially when you see the big, like, classic BLM protests on television and the streets are just full and blocked and everything. But for a small town, a small city like Troy, with a historically pretty conservative and kind of racist history, you know, it wasn't a huge crowd, but I thought it was a respectable size.
Right, and, yeah. And there were like a lot of news crews. I saw like four different news channels. Like I saw Spectrum out there. I saw, I don't know, all the news channels. There were a couple of different people out there, so they definitely got the coverage.
I also thought the rally grew with time. The more people were at the farmers market and they'd see it and come by and stick around, and there were people driving by that were interested in trying to. They received, I think, pamphlets that just gave a rundown of what was going on.
Yeah, that's true. Because I started at the beginning, which was the spot where Dominique was, I think, originally shot. I don't know what
9th and Rensselaer Street.
Yeah, so it started at 9th and Rensselaer, and thank you. And it went all the way down to the farmers market, and the people definitely like joined the rally on the way.
Yeah, that's what I did.
which is really, really cool. So why do you think that this, you know, issue was so important to all these people that went?
I think because it's just a serious thing that is happening all over, and when it happens right in your own backyard, I think people felt the need to talk about it and make it known that it's not okay. Obviously, I think both instances for Thevenin and McDonald took place at initially just traffic stops, and it shouldn't have to escalate that much, or it shouldn't have ended the way it did. It shouldn't be fatal, and I think We just want to make sure, like, the community wants to make sure that Troy Police is doing their job and not, like, making things worse than they have to be.
Yeah, definitely. And from conversations I've had with, like, Messiah Cooper, who's Dominique's uncle, and other folks from that neighborhood, when Edson Thevenin was killed by the police, there wasn't so much of a community response. So now, this time when Dominique got shot, they, I think, saw it as, like, a wake-up call and also an opportunity to be able to mobilize in a way that they hadn't done originally.
That's also what I saw. I honestly, until hearing about the protest for Dominique McDonald, I hadn't heard of Edson Thevenin, and that's, like, really kind of upsetting that it was suppressed that much as an event that happened.
Yeah, me too. And I was also surprised to learn that Edson Thevenin was also shot in a vehicle. It seems like there's, like, this, you know, this repeating of the same thing, which is good that, you know, now people are organizing much more around it, because I think there's been this discussion around a vehicle being considered a weapon, which I think is crazy. That means every time you stop me for speeding, like, you can shoot me because I have a weapon. No, that's insane. And I think there definitely needs to be some real discussion with city officials clearing that up and, like, making, like real official discussion about that. And also, obviously, there needs to be accountability for these officers who are doing things that maybe they, not even maybe, that they should not be doing. You know, there's ways to go about this. I don't know, like, I think people always have, like, these complaints, but no one knows how to fix it. You know, do you guys have any, like, ideas of maybe things that they could do to be better at their jobs?
Yeah, well, I think there are people who do know how to fix it. I wouldn't say that I'm that person, but I think that there are organizers and organizations who are very knowledgeable and who've been trying for a long time to communicate constructively with the authorities. And the first thing that the people in power need to do is to listen to the ideas of the people who are coming to them. Because I think there are people who know what they're talking about and have good responses and ideas about how to fix policing. But maybe, do you feel similarly? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in no position to tell cops how to do their job, but I totally resonated with me that you're saying that they're taking cars and considering them weapons, because I'm pretty sure both victims were completely unarmed. And even I've been, like, in a routine traffic stop, and they have multiple cop cars come over, and it was honestly threatening. And, like I'm not even black. Like, I don't know how much worse it could have been for other people.
I remember the first time I ever got pulled over, and I wasn't even speeding. It was something crazy. Like, I didn't yield to emergency vehicle. I was, like, 17, and I pulled over when the lights went on, and while I was there, like, four other cop cars came, and I'm just, like, at this, like, come and go. It's like a gas station, and it just was like, oh my god, I'm gonna die. I was, like, super, super nervous, and it was, like, 11 o'clock at night. It was just bad. But they were nice. I didn't, you know, experience anything crazy at that traffic stop, but I totally get, you know, what you're saying about feeling this intimidation, and maybe it's not necessary to have a million cop cars for one traffic stop.
Yeah, it just seems very combative, and there needs to be, the bridge needs to be, like, made between cops wanting to harm the individual and the individual wanting to harm cops. Like, we shouldn't be afraid of them. They shouldn't be afraid of us.
I think that's what community policing is supposed to be.
Yeah, I remember at the first rally that happened in August, I think, and we were all gathered outside the city hall waiting for the mayor to come out, and I heard some conversations between people from the 9th and Rensselaer neighborhood and cops and the people were saying, like, what happened? Like, well, I remember being a kid and we would play basketball with you, you know? And now when you come through the neighborhood, people are scared and they go inside, you know? And I have a hard time imagining a world in which I walk down the street and see cops playing basketball with, like, community members. That's just, like, so far outside of my realm of experience. But yeah, apparently that used to be how it was. And I think the nature of community policing is such that, like, when you get pulled over, you shouldn't be afraid because you should personally already have a relationship with that officer.
That's super, super true. And I think another thing that may be beneficial is just, like, maybe requesting or demanding certain amounts of trainings from our local police departments, you know, like crisis intervention training and trauma training. And, you know, I think things progress as time goes on, and you have to continue to educate yourself on how to handle situations and what to do about them. So, I mean, I'm not a police officer either, but I think that that job is insanely, just way too much pressure. But.
All right, so I think at this time, we're going to be hearing from Anastasia, who was a former city council member, and she spoke at the rally. She had a lot to say, so this is just a short excerpt of what she spoke to the rally about.
2017 shot and thankfully alive, and now coerced to take a three-year plea, shot by police officer Jared Ilya, Dameek McDonald. Say his name.
Dameek McDonald, we stand on justice.
So what exactly do we want, you ask? So for number one, we seek justice and a calling for intervention by the Attorney General. Number two, we seek justice where cases of brutality are brought to light by full and impartial investigation of officers involved and held accountable by prosecution. Number three, we seek justice in the formation of a civilian review board made up of the majority of those that are in the jail and prison system with subpoena power and real-time investigative authority. Number four, we seek justice by means of an end to racial profiling through an overhaul of political and police procedures and philosophy, which encourage and support behaviors and practices of racism, sexism, heterosexism, class, and ableism. Five, we seek justice through the development of a sustainable partnership with the city's administration, police officials, city council, and community members commissions to establish new and practical, sustainable benchmarks of progress towards that end. What we seek is not attainable overnight. Why are you? Why are we? We are here because we stand on justice. We want justice, and justice is truth. Ashe.
That was Anastasia. What's Anastasia's last name?
Robertson.
I think she used to be on the Troy City Council, and she went through and listed all the people who had been subjected to questionable treatment by Troy Police Department.
That have reported it anyway.
Right, exactly. And we have a couple more clips, too. Monica, you want to tell us about the other clips we have?
Yeah, so I was on the scene, and I just talked to a couple people that were in the crowd because I wanted to know how much they knew about it and why they were there. So the first clip we'd like to play is from actually a student of Rensselaer Polytechnic. Her name is Janari Mitchell. And there's a few questions in the interview you can hear.
So as an RPI student, have you seen events like this or anything have any presence at Rensselaer Polytechnic?
These incidents are not even discussed at RPI, and when we try to discuss them, like post them in a Facebook group, we're penalized for it, and the students get upset. One student, after posting the article, she said, why are we posting this now? This happened in August. And then another student said, there's nothing we can do, as if we shouldn't even shed light on the situation.
What about as a new member of the Troy community, what have you seen about Troy? Do you think they're good at coming together about stuff like this, or do you think there's a lot that needs to be done? Do you think the protest is going to be worthwhile?
I think that any protest is worthwhile, but what confuses me is how this protest is so small compared to RPI protests and how many members are in the city right now.
Since you weren't here in August, you obviously have no connection to Dameek, but what is important to you about this, and why did you come out today?
I came out today because this happened so close to campus and I didn't even hear about it. The murders of black men have been so normalized in society that it's not even good enough for national news or for people to even talk about it.
That was Janari
Mitchell,
RPI student who was at the rally, and our correspondent caught up with her and talked to her about it.
I also spoke to Karen Dyer. She is a resident of Troy that lived very close to where to make McDonald was shot. I don't think she knew him, but she was around there over the summer, and here's what she had to say about that.
It's just disheartening to hear that nothing has been done, that a body can be near death and no one can be held accountable for it. So I'm out here just trying to support the cause of holding police accountable for their actions and for what they're doing. That's just absolutely unjustful.
What would you like to see happen after today?
I want to see the cop accountable. I want to see him prosecuted. I want a trial to be in place, and I want Damiek to be vindicated. His life was almost lost, and nobody's being held accountable for it. So I just want that process to happen.
Cool. Thanks for getting those recordings, Monica. What was that last person's name?
Karen Dyer. She's a resident of Troy. I lived close to Damiek McDonald.
Jonah, don't you live close to Damiek too, or close to the scene of the crime?
Yeah, I live a few blocks away, and I was the day of the shooting. I was there a few hours later at night, and it was pretty alarming. If anyone has a chance to go look at pictures of the scene that night, there was a couple dozen community members sort of standing in the street waiting to find out information, and a lot of people really upset and sad, you know. And in response, the city put up a barricade of riot police, you know, and there's just no communication between the mayor didn't come. No one came to talk to the people about what was going on. There was a really sketchy hazmat van that showed up and for like God knows what reasons. And basically there was just like this intense scene of on one side, community members mourning, literally just like mourning in the street. And on the other side, the police aggressively posturing with you know, weapons and shields and stuff.
It's funny you talk about the disconnect, because at the rally, one thing that his uncle, Damiek's uncle, Messiah, talked about was how, like, when he went to the hospital, how he, like, woke up to, like, a cop staring him down, and he felt like that was unnecessarily harsh, and, like, there should have been, like, a family member there with him. And, you know, there's definitely, you know, obviously some tension and some weirdness between police community and the actual community. But I think this is all the time we have for this segment.
I guess thank you, Monica, for being there on the scene and recording that and for being here to talk about it with us. Do you have any last thoughts you wanted to share with folks before we close the segment out?
Not much. I'm just thankful to be here and thankful to bring more of an audience to an important cause.
Thank you, Monica.
So for our next segment, Uzma Popol is the volunteer coordinator for the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project, an organization that's been going strong for 4 years in the capital region. Tatiana had the chance to talk more about MSKP with Uzma, and she shined a light on the incredible work they've been doing.
MSKP is the Muslim Soup Kitchen Project. It actually started in 2003 by a group of RPI students. They wanted to give back to the community, so they started to do monthly soup kitchens. So it started in 2003, and now in 2017, it has increased the amount of projects that they do. So we don't only do the monthly soup kitchens at one place every month. It's grown to at least three places every month.
What places are those?
Well, we have a list of shelters and homeless shelters all across the capital region that we do. Sometimes we do a different one every month. But most of the times we do Joseph's House in Troy. We used to do Unity House when they used to have their meals on the weekends, but they don't do that anymore. We do City Missions in Schenectady. There's many in Albany, St. John, St. Anne's, I can't think of on top of my head, but there's at least about 26 different organizations that we help out.
In 4 years, that's a long time. Do RPI students, are RPI students really still active in it for, you know, now that it's been 4 years later?
Well, originally the RPI students that started it, one of them is on the board, I believe. Yes, one of them is on the board. And we do have, it's not just RPI students anymore. We have SUNY MSAs, Muslim Student Associations, our Hudson Valley MSAs. So all the different MSAs locally participate and help out.
On average, how many volunteers do you have volunteer a month?
Well, for the soup kitchens by themselves, we would have about at least 50 to 60 volunteers we need, because we do need cooks, we need on-site volunteers, and we need people to organize and prepare for it.
Wow, sounds like a lot of people. Do you have to be Muslim to volunteer with the Muslim soup kitchen?
No, we don't. We have actually lots of different people from all different faiths and nationalities. Anybody can help, really. It's all about serving, creating unity through serving humanity. And that's what we do try to do. For example, in December, we have the Jewish community and the Muslim community coming together to deliver meals in Troy for all the our Christian brothers and sisters.
That sounds really, really cool. Where do you get your food and donations from?
Well, people just donate, like, for example, here at Al Hidayah Center, they donate to us. We have the Muslim community that donates to us. Anyone that hears about MSKP, somebody wants to donate. So we do, it's just regular donations every day. We don't have any grants or anything yet. So just people being generous.
That's really cool. How many meals do you pass out within a month?
So we do about 300 to 500 meals. We don't want to go over that just now, only because we do have lack of funds. You know, we want to make sure that we're able to help every month, be consistent. However, April 29th, so the last weekend of April, we do have a national Muslim Soup Kitchen Day, in which we don't just serve the capital region. We get other organizations to participate. And they, I believe we had over 30 organizations in like 16 different states participating in the National Muslim Soup Kitchen Day.
Wow, that sounds really fun. Really, really fun. What other programs besides serving meals does the Muslim Soup Kitchen program do?
We do have the bi-monthly drives, which we, every other month, we hold a drive. And sometimes we have like winter clothing, winter hats and gloves. We do that. Sometimes we have toiletry drives. Sometimes we have fruits and vegetables. So pretty much whatever shelters or families in need have the need for, we get all the communities together and have a drive at their own locations at the same time in the same amount of period of time, where we and then they all bring it here in one place. So with that, we distribute it to local shelters, local families, anywhere, anyone that needs it. So that's the bi-monthly drive. We also do have the freezers at a couple different locations where people can go and donate meat, because that's one of the items that it's really hard for the shelters and it's expensive to keep up is meat. So we try to donate whatever we can to local families. And we do have like only halal meat. So I know it's more expensive, but people have been generous. And whenever they donate, we try to give it to, you know, Unity House. And there's a lot of refugees, families, and we try to provide for them as well. Another one we have is the Ramadan Hunger Appeal. And in this one, during Ramadan, a lot of people, a lot of Muslims are tend to be more generous and they want to give. And so we try to collect as much as we can money to help the Northeastern Regional Food Bank. So last year we collected over 1,400 and this year it was a little over that as well. So every year we hope to increase and try to help our community as much as possible. Another project, and we have many projects, so this is the last one that I'm going to talk about, is the Visiting the Sick and the Elderly. Every month, we get together and visit like the nursing homes. We visit someone who is sick, maybe with cancer. We try to brighten up their day. And that really is really special to a lot of places that we go to. And they look forward to us coming back. And us volunteers, we go there and we see everyone, and it makes us be grateful for our health that we have.
It sounds like you guys do a lot of incredible things. Why do you think that this is so important?
Charity in general, that's a big part of Islam. That's one of our pillars. So Islam has five pillars, and one is charity. And it's, to me, not only me, but everyone I know, like giving charity to make sure that we take care of those that are not able to take care of themselves. And even like smile is a charity. So if we can go out there, give smiles and make people happy, that itself is very important. And at MSKP, it's faith. MSKP puts faith to practice by providing food for the homeless and help those in need. And with all these other our projects, we try to do the same thing. We engage our youth in service and strive to fulfill our duty to our neighbors. We believe we are one in essence, in respective to our colors and beliefs, and share the need to serve humanity through unity with uniting our family, friends, neighbors, and community members.
What projects do you have coming up? And you talked about the bi-monthly projects. Do you have anything, you know, within the next 2 months outside of the giving dinners to Christian brothers and sisters? Do you have anything else coming up?
Yep. So the one that we're getting together to serve the Christmas meals. On top of that, we do have the monthly soup kitchens that we're doing in addition to that. And we also will be collecting in December gloves and hats and winter items, as well as, like I said, you know, we're visiting the sick. So we have somebody we're going to visit next week. And then we have a youth group coming together to go visit a nursing home in December.
How can people find out more about the Muslim Soup Kitchen program?
Well, they can go onto our website, mskp.info. We have a Facebook page. They can go there. And they can always contact mskpcapdistrict@gmail.com. And they can also come to one of our volunteer sessions. We have one volunteer session that's coming up. That's December 5th. That's a Tuesday, December 5th from 6 to 7.
And where is that located?
It'll be located here at 322 Troy Schenectady Road.
Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, that was WOOC correspondent Tatiana Moreni and Uzma Popol talking about the Muslim Soup Kitchen. To learn more and donate to the Muslim Soup Kitchen, visit their website at mskp.info. I'm Jonah Moberg. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOC's 105.3 FM Troy, which you can hear at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. every weekday.
To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit our website at mediasanctuary.org.
Oh, sorry. Our next segment, Tech Valley Game Space is a community of game producers with a studio on 3rd Street in Troy, New York. Its members gather for weekly meetings to socialize, work together on group projects, and to coordinate the hosting of monthly events, such as presentations, classes, workshops, exhibitions of locally created games, and playtesting sessions of works in progress. WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati sat down with the executive director and the education coordinator of Tech Valley Game Space to talk with them about their organization's activities and its sense of social mission.
I'm Aaron Pettinati, and today I'm interviewing Frederica Edgington Giordano, the volunteer education coordinator and secretary of the board at Tech Valley Game Space, along with Taro Amiya, the events coordinator and executive director of Tech Valley Game Space. So to start out, I'm hoping that the two of you can unpack the definition of a game space in general. What is a game space? What are these game spaces that are cropping up all over the place, from cities in Canada to Buffalo to Philadelphia and New York City? Can you just give us a basic sense?
Yeah, sure thing, Aaron. It is very simple. A game space definition is as simple as basically a shared office space that people rent together, share resources, and so forth. It's basically another co-working space, except focused on the game development end of things. So these can include not just programming things, but also include art, music, and business development, and of course, programming as well.
Okay, so what makes Tech Valley Game Space in Troy, New York, unique as a game space? What are its functions? What are its objectives? What's it about?
Good question. So the Tech Valley Game Space is a game developer community here in the capital region of New York. We were founded on a principle that games and game making are for everyone, and we basically aim to create this inclusive co-working space as well as a community for using a couple of different ways. The first method that we do, of course, is the aforementioned having a co-working space at all for the hobbyist, independent game developers, and occasional professionals who has those kind of hobbyist projects that they have to our location. But the second one includes events that we do, a lot of these free public events here at the space to generally organize around the idea of trying to teach and encourage people to make games themselves. And with that, also, the last thing that we do is to create these educational programs, which Frederica can go more into details about.
So those include, and we'll be talking about this more, our lesson night, our Orbit program, which is new this year, where we provide free educational programs and content to the public for children, adults, anyone who's interested in making a game.
Okay. So how does Tech Valley Game Space incorporate ideals such as community building and the fostering of diversity into its overall sense of mission? Frederica, I'm going to let you take this one since you're the education coordinator here.
So we have, well, like Tara said, we have our free events open to the public. We started out with the free Wednesday events as well. For every Wednesday night, we had an event, depending on which Wednesday night, it was a different event, covering all different kinds of aspects of game development. We also have the Orbit program, where we have actual game and professionals, game creation professionals teach. I also actually teach as well. I'm a hobbyist, but I'm able to teach the beginner game development as well. We also do our Include events, which are the Include game jams, actually. Game jams are kind of like a hackathon for games, where, and if you don't know what a hackathon is, I'll explain, you make a game in a set period of time. In the case of the Include events, it's either 2 days or 1 day. We teach people who've never made a game before from underrepresented groups, most recently the LGBTQ game jam, where individuals who've never made a game before create their own game in the course of a day. So do you want to talk about it?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, Tara, if you could comment on this as well. The ways in which Tech Valley Game Space is trying to foster a sense of community and diversity within the overall gaming projects that it's pursuing. Mm-hmm.
Of course, I'd like to cover the co-working end of things. In our co-working office here, we have a code of conduct that we actively enforce, which all of us coordinators are trained on working on. Basically, that's kind of it. We don't say no to any sort of person that has like an art project, a music project, or anything like that, so long as they're willing to, they're okay with and are able to comply with the code of conduct that we enforce here, which, one of the first rules is don't make assumptions about people.
So would you say that there's a sense of a larger social mission that's informing what Tech Valley Game Space is up to?
Yes. When Jamie and I started the co-working office, we were both in agreement with and were in line with the mission of not just creating a more flourishing game development environment here, but also to get as many diverse voices as possible, whether they be from an underrepresented minority or from women in particular. For us to, we thought that the future of game development in regards to where the market was going, where the new startups would be born out of and be able to focus on the creating these new and important experiences, would be going down to largely these underrepresented groups. Because, let's face it, I think a lot of the major players already have the majority audience firm in their iron hands, but you know, there's always those underserved people where smaller projects can be born out of, and a lot of great, amazing things can be made that we hope will, you know, eventually, and I think I would argue even working in general right now to the greater audience as well.
So can you tell us a little bit about some of the games that have been developed out of Tech Valley Game Space? Is it just video games, or is it also board games, strategy games? What sorts of games? I also, outside this room, we're in Tech Valley Game Space right now, have seen all sorts of interesting contraptions, including 3D printers, and if you give a sense of what those are being used for, that would be great.
All right, so I'll start. So to answer your initial question of what sort of games comes out of Tech Valley Game Space, we accept any sort of games, including analog games. These include board games, card games, tabletop games, social games, as well as video games as well. Now, we're not going to lie, a lot of us were originally interested in making board games, and so this list is going to, unfortunately, largely comprise of that. But to be absolutely clear, those things are always on the table. We are totally okay with, and have even been discussing about having future events in making board games and card games and social games as well. Anyways, in regards to listing out a couple of games that are created here from the Tech Valley Game Space, Slap Friends was an Out Control GDC 2016 Out Control winning nominee and Experimental Gameplay Workshop winning nominee. So that's like internationally famous game created by just two people here in the space, amongst other people that were joined in the project as the number of needs increased. But the Slap Friends game is best described as you wear puppets hats as the controller itself, and you swing their noodly arms to control the noodly arms in a fighting game about slapping each other.
That's great.
Yeah, that was that. The other game that extraordinarily had a lot of pedigree. So I personally make a lot of games myself. I think like I have almost over 30 of them on my own website. But one of them, the Recursive Dollhouse, which was created for Ludum Dare, another game jam that's online and actually quite popular, made first place on Innovation, and that is a game that involves a dollhouse that you start off with inside, and there's another dollhouse in there, and you can jump into that dollhouse to go in to realize there's another dollhouse in there, so on and so forth. It's a surreal puzzle game where you have to deal with an endless number of dollhouses.
So one of my creations, I make primarily narrative-based games, created with RenPy, which is a visual novel engine. I made Waiting for Sleep, which is a game about insomnia. It actually was created for a game jam in another for another country. It was for charity, actually, for a UK charity that helped trans individuals with their medical needs. So I donated that time for that. And I guess I can talk about Jamie's games, yeah. Troy Trilogy, which is a series of three games focused on different aspects of Troy and different parts of history in Troy, mm-hmm. like Uncle Sam, and Native American legend, and also the sort of a future history kind of look at Troy, right. Which was kind of a neat game. We also have on itch.io, which is a website where you can post your own indie games. We have our own page where anyone interested can check out other games. We have a lot of games that have been posted on itch.io, and we kind of put them all up on this sort of website all together. So, and then there's the interactive showcase where game makers can get feedback on their games. So anyone, not just someone who's already like an established member of our group, can come in, plug in their game on one of the computers and get some feedback from the public, which is actually a really positive experience. I've done that with my own games as well, and Taro has given me quite a bit of feedback too. And we had over 30 games in the first year, so that's actually these are sort of the highlights.
That last game that you mentioned, or the second last game that you mentioned about a Troy-based game, kind of anticipated my last question for you, which is whether or not you're dealing with any specific capital region-related game themes. And it sounds like you have at least one, but just quickly, are there any others that you can talk about?
So actually, this was born from what we call the local history game jam, where it was obviously focused on the local history of Hira in upstate New York. Jamie obviously made a few of them born from that game jam, as well as just on his own. I actually made one as well, which surprisingly had an game journalist article at one point called Amanda Cluett, which was intended to be this cookie clicker game that's supposed to slowly tell you the narrative story of Amanda Cluett, who was a real person that was instrumental to the women's suffrage movement. But ironically, she has presented herself as anti-suffrage. And I kind of gave like a wonky reason in the in-game itself, but in reality, she has been actually behind her husband's back, been donating to all sorts of these programs that would have helped women get better education and really overcome the limitation of having no voting rights.
Okay, well, that sounds like a lot of interesting ways in which the games that you're working on are connected to local issues and local history. Thanks, Frederica and Taro, for sitting down and talking to me today. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you both.
And thank you very much, Aaron. Yeah.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
That was WOOC correspondent Aaron Pettinati interviewing the good folks at Tech Valley Game Space.
Now in the studio, we have Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books. Market Block Books is a bookstore here in Troy, and Stanley comes by every week. Stanley, I'm looking at your stack of books here, and they all look like they're food-themed.
Well, hello, and no, not all food, but, you know, it's Thanksgiving week, so what do we think about?
Right, food. It's all we think about.
So I brought a book back by popular demand. This is Thich Nhat Hanh's book, How to Eat. And I love one of the meditations in here is where he says, you know, delicious doesn't mean it's healthy. And we have to figure out what we understand by delicious versus healthy. And there's a lot of other dynamics that we as Americans have weird issues with food, as you can tell by the fact that we have organic versus non-organic, and the cost of food is overpriced at times or out of range for a lot of folks. And then we have a town like Troy, which is basically a food desert, where you can't get food options in this city unless you go to the suburbs. There's no grocery store near my house. I live in South Troy. I have to take the bus or borrow a car or carpool with someone. There's no way to get decent food. And so it's very frustrating. So hence, I'm talking about food, but not necessarily in the, oh boy, I can't wait to eat Thanksgiving Day concept.
I see. I actually got this How to Eat Thich Nhat Hanh book because you requested it. And I find it very simple to read and really, I guess, enlightening would be the word.
Yeah. There's one little thing where he says, chew on your green beans and not on your anger. I love that. It's like, oh.
Yeah, that is good. He's
a gorgeous man. I just I can't get enough of Thich Nhat Hanh. And lately, it's what I start my day reading is Thich Nhat Hanh. So the next book is called Lentil Underground. This is Renegade Farmers in the Future of Food in America and the Future of Food in America by Liz Carlisle. This is not a new book, but it's an important book. And Susan Taylor, one of my coworkers, does the happy dance whenever someone buys this book and she gets a chance to talk about it. Liz Carlisle was a country and western singer. She's from Montana. She got involved as an intern for one of the state senators. But she also got to meet this one farmer there who decided that he didn't want to do the industrial farming methods that were forcing small farmers out of their livelihood. So he started planting organic lentils, and lentils replenish the soil. You know, they put things back and they fertilize things. And so there's so much in this book. And I have a suspicion, actually, I'm sorry, Susan has a suspicion that Liz Carlisle will probably run for public office one day and we should all vote for her, move to her state and vote for her.
Montana?
Montana.
Montana, a wonderful state.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
So And
I think that it's interesting that there are non-organic like options available. I feel like, and this may be like too overreach for government, but I feel like if there's food that is not healthy, then it shouldn't even really be accessible.
Well, and other countries believe that. And here's the problem in the United States, and I'm no expert on this, but there are farmers that don't use pesticides and chemicals, but they can't call themselves organic because they don't have that FDA stamp of approval.
I saw a documentary about that.
Yeah, so I buy conventional foods at the co-op, the Honest Weight Food Co-op.
I love the co-op.
I do too. I was there today.
I like that you can, like the seasonings and stuff, like you can just take what you need. You don't have to buy like a whole container of like McCormick curry powder or something. You can just get like a scoop, or you can buy like a whole lot and it's still not as expensive. Like you can literally get like 26 cents worth of flour.
Right. Just what you need.
Yeah.
Instead of a 5-pound bag.
Yeah, I think that kind of helps with like I feel like if you buy more food than you need, then obviously you're probably going to eat more food than you need to eat.
Or waste it. Waste is a big problem.
Yeah, that's even worse maybe.
Well, I'll talk about that some other time. I don't have a wasting book today. But I will. I'll bring one.
What else you got?
The next one is the best food writing for 2017. So this is a collection of all kinds of articles from all kinds of folks, from everything that's, TV, chefs, and issues. There's one of my favorite books I brought in a couple of weeks back was called The Cooking Gene by Michael Twitty. And so he talks in there about the whole issue of being black, about being gay, and having good food choices. So that's an essay, an article on that.
Sounds very interesting.
So I am a big fan of things like that because these are articles that you can kind of read instead of sometimes you can't be committed to a whole book. And that's a great way to dip in and get a sense of the world of food writing over the last year.
What kind of fruit or what is this on the front?
It's a fig on the front.
Oh.
Huh.
They're pretty.
And my neighbor makes the best fig and prosciutto pizza you've ever had.
That
oh, my goodness.
Just
oh,
like
my
decadent.
Goodness. It's not. Yes, it is and it's not.
I believe it.
So the next thing I have is a little collection of books called Poems of Gratitude. Now, this company, this is Everyman Library, puts out collections of books of poetry all the time. And this one is about giving thanks on different levels, family, life. And there are contemporary poets in there and the traditional classic poets, Wordsworth and Keats. But Mary Oliver is in there. Billy Collins is in there. Maya Angelou is in there. She has a gorgeous poem, a thank you prayer that I just love in the reverence section. Reverence. So, these are nice little books. They have a sweet little ribbon in them. They're good gift items. They're beautifully bound. If you take the dust jacket off, you see how nice they look underneath, the undercover, we call it, or I call it. I keep making up words all the time. I am a trained professional,
A trained professional making up words?
Bookseller. These are book terms. I'm making up book terms.
Gotcha.
But I think it actually is called The Undercover by somebody. I heard this somewhere. Allegedly. Oh my gosh. Here's a food book I forgot to mention earlier. This is called Fast Food Genocide. And you're probably thinking automatically McDonald's is the culprit here. But really, deli meats, cheese, any kind of processed food, breads that we are buying, they're killing us. And they're killing the people who don't have access to whole foods and whole grains.
I 100% agree. I think every Monday we have a sandwich day here at the sanctuary. And every Monday I talk about how deli meat is not good for you. And we also have like debates on like what kind of cheese is good cheese. And that's another thing, though.
So this guy, Joel Fuhrman, is a doctor, and he wrote a previous book called Eat to Live and talks about how to eat properly and healthy. So this is a follow-up to that book.
I have heard of that book. Yeah. I think my mom sent me that in like a PDF form. She emailed it to me.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, we had a very heated discussion about it.
I want to talk about two children's books. These are biographies for children. They're done in a picture book format. And since we're talking about food, I'll go to the Joyce Chen book first. This is called Dumpling Dreams by Carrie Clickard and illustrated by Katie Wu. And it's a story of Joyce Chen growing up in China and leaving China when the war began between China and Japan, and then escaping to San Francisco and eventually ending up in Boston, where she starts introducing Chinese food to the Boston community in the 40s.
It looks like there's some Chinese words in here.
Yeah, and also at the very end of the book, she has a recipe for dumplings and dumpling sauces. I am of that era, ancient for you, Tatiana, but where Joyce Chen was big on PBS, and I used to watch her. I've always been obsessed with food, even as a kid. I taught myself to make enchiladas when I was in 10th grade, even though we had none of the products in Albany, New York at the time. But I figured out how to make them, even though I had no idea what they were. But I was taking Spanish. I should learn how to make enchiladas.
That happened to me, too, but different. What's it called? Baklava. I made baklava in, I think it was like 5th or 6th grade.
Brave.
And my mom really ended up making it. She actually knew how to make it. And I remember thinking, like, why have you never made this for us then if you know how to make it? It's actually pretty easy to make. Just get like the, I think it's called phyllo dough or something like that.
Right.
And you just lay it on there with like the nuts and stuff. Hmm. But this book looks really, really cool.
It's very sweet. And it's got a kind of a sing-songy text to it. So it, I think kids will like it. Parents will like reading it. So the next book is a book about the architect Zaha Hadid, who was from Iraq. She's Muslim, and she started seeing forms in nature and decided to take that and create architectural concepts based on natural forms. So, so she did quite a number of things, but because she was a woman, because everyone perceived her as Arab, they wouldn't execute her designs. In fact, she won a competition. They found out she was a woman and she was Arab. They said no. So she re-entered and she won it again. Uh-huh. And she just kept proving that her concepts were way ahead of the game.
Well, that sounds incredible.
And this is like one of these really creative, artistic, beautiful books that kids will be inspired by, because she doesn't deal with lines and angles, but she looks at form and nature. I love that little book. It's beautiful.
The illustration in the book is actually is definitely very, very pretty. And
it's like an
and
art
a little
book.
Funky.
Yeah.
But I think we are out of time, Stanley. Yeah, we never have enough time for the book segment, do we?
Well, I guess we'll need more time.
Well, if you are just tuning in, Capital Region, this is Stanley Hatzel from Market Block Books. He brings us a stack of books every week. He's a great picker of books. But that concludes our show tonight. Once again, we hope that you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Tatiana Morani.
And I'm Jonah Moberg. Remember to tune back in tomorrow and every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to get your daily dose of local news.
To learn more about this program and about how you can support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, feel free to visit our website at mediasanctuary.org. If you'd like information on how you can participate in the production of this program or even have suggestions on stories you think would be cool, just send us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org.
And we'll take this moment to remind our audience that WOOC is run completely by volunteers. We welcome anyone with a desire to participate, whether you have a lot of experience or no experience. If you're interested in being a part of the radio crew, we hold weekly meetings Mondays and Thursdays right after the show at 7:07 p.m. You can come by the Sanctuary for Independent Media located at 3361 6th Avenue in Troy, New York.
Don't forget to tune back in again every day to listen to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. We've got lots in store for you for the rest of this week. Thank you, guys. Have a good night.